If a player cleans his ball during play of a hole, except on the putting green, he shall incur a penalty of one stroke. That's the rule, Jerry.
But it's just a friendly game. Why do you always have to be such a stickler?
Because that's the way I was raised.
Welcome to Spirit of the Game, brought to you by the Colorado Golf Association. Here are your hosts, Ed Mate and Lewis Harry.
Okay, we are back for another edition of the Spirit of the Game. It is a new month, a new short month, although a little longer than normal because it is a leap year. You realize that?
It is.
Yeah. If you didn't recognize our voices already, this is Ed Mate doing most of the talking and joined by the guy who's going to do most of the talking on this because you're definitely better qualified. And that's the one and only Lewis Harry.
That's right.
So, yeah, let's see. We're recording this late January for a February 1st launch. The topic today is learning the rules of golf. So you're listening and you want to, our assumption is the fact that you're tuned into this, it's surging in popularity, by the way. I'm sure the numbers will support me in that. That's just a sense I get. But the topic we're gonna focus on is learning the rules, all the way from just a little bit to really becoming a rules official and what's involved in that and everything in between. I'll just kick it off by saying that golf is the only sport, maybe other sports are similar in some regards, maybe in tennis you call your ins and your outs and your double faults and all that, but golf is really the only game, particularly as you move up the ladder into more serious competition, where you really are your own referee. You have to call penalties on yourself. I've never seen that happen in any other sport. So there's sort of a baked-in requirement almost, if you're going to play golf, to know the rules a little bit better. Anybody can watch football on TV, and granted, you're not playing. You don't need to know the rules. Football players don't need to know the rules. They just play the game. So what are your thoughts on just the surface of this conversation?
I think it's interesting that in the rules of golf themselves, they're structured in a way to where in other sports, I think I've mentioned this on other podcasts before when we're talking about penalties and things like that. But I think what's interesting about the rules and the way they're structured in golf is that in other sports, it may be part of the strategy of the game to break the rules. In basketball, you know, there's intentional fouling in basketball.
Well, remember, there is one guy who did that.
Well, aside from the outliers here, but
yeah, you know who I'm talking about.
Yeah, in football, maybe it's, you know, in your best interest to take a false start,
sure,
to the back 5 yards. The rules in 99% of the situations, there's no strategy in which breaking the rules should benefit you.
Right.
Right. And I think it's interesting that in the way that works is, like I said, it's a very self-policing game. You're your own referee. In the way that works is that most players that need to know those rules to make their strategy in playing the game and in calling penalties on themselves, most players don't. I would say that if you break the rule book down, that some players know about 10% of the rule book and the other 90% is completely unknown, which I think David Stabler used to say at 85-15, if you know 15% of the rule book, you're on pretty good footing, mm-hmm, and you can mostly play a round of golf and get through okay without doing anything major. And the other 85%, you know, leave that to the other people. I think it's more in reality closer to 10. A lot of people know about 10% of the rule, mm-hmm, book. But again, they're not the easiest rules to learn. I would say some of them are, but in basketball, I think you can learn some surface level rules in the game of basketball and get by. Mm-hmm. Same thing with, you know, maybe baseball, soccer, maybe. I don't know. I'm not a big soccer guy, but I think in other sports you can learn some surface level rules and really get by with learning how to play the game.
Right.
Golf is so unique to where you really do need to learn a little bit more than the surface level.
Right. Well, probably the first piece of advice I always give when it comes to somebody who's really interested in learning the rules, they've expressed a real desire to do that, is absolutely master the definitions. I say all the time, this is not unique to me, anybody who's studied the rules knows this, that the rules define the game and the definitions define the rules. And if you understand the definitions very, really, really, really well, that really is the foundation to build on. So whether you want to just get a better understanding of them, just get your mind around the terminology, obviously, it's like speaking a language. You have to know those definitions. The other thing I would say, and I just thought of this, that's kind of should be added, and it was a really good addition to the rules in 2019, are the purpose statements. Because those purpose statements answer why. So if you understand why the rules are, and then you understand the definitions, then you're really in a solid spot to really dive into the book. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would say so. Anytime I recommend people learning the rules, or their first time, either whether it's studying for an exam or they're just diving in on their own, I always recommend going through the definitions before you read any 1 through 25. Because again, you really need to understand how those terms work within the rules. A good example, there was a temporary immovable obstruction ruling on tour recently, where there was a player's ball lost in a TIO, and however it unfolded, but the concept of known or virtually certain came up, and a lot of discourse on Twitter about people disagreeing about the rule, how the rule works, what happened to the ball, whatever the case was. And there was a lot of confusion around virtually certain. I think it's just people having their own idea of how virtually certain works when not a lot of them realize that it's defined in the rules of golf. You can go read the definition of it, understand what it means, and it's right there in black and white for you. So I do think having a fundamental hold on the definitions is really where you need to start before you read any of the rules 1 through 25.
Right. So if you look at, before we move up the ladder of interest to the casual all the way up to the geeks, that's the highest rung of the ladder, the geeks. I'm proud to be a wannabe geek now. I wouldn't even call myself a geek because my knowledge continues to slip a little bit every year, and the videos we do, I lean on you more and more heavily, and that's why we'd be out there all day to do one video if it were up to me. But I would say, and I'm just thinking out loud here, all the rules seminars I've done, the first of all, if you come to a rules seminar, you're already more interested than most.
Than the average Joe.
Right. But golfers, we could probably come up with five or six sort of monikers for these. You have the golfer, the guy who, or gal, usually guy, who's kind of the Rodney Dangerfield, in the room, who's, everything's a joke when it comes to the rules. Rules, what are rules? So you have a lot of people that kind of have that, at least. I think that's a fairly small number, at least in our world, because I don't know, my experience is people really are interested in the rules. They really want to do the right thing, and we all follow the rules when we get behind the wheel of a car, at least we try to, and we know that there's a reason we do that, for safety, and I don't know. So I'd say that'd be a pretty small group. And then the next big group would be the tournament player, who really is interested in knowing the rules because they play competitively and maybe want to, they're almost looking at it as an opportunity to gain an advantage. You have that type of rules interested person. The rare bird is the one who really wants to become a rules official, somebody who's so interested in them that they actually want to volunteer their time to become an expert. And that's equally small. So, and everything in between. What other types of rules wannabes do you see out there?
I think you probably covered it. I think once you get past that person who wants to get more involved and actually get into officiating, I think it just kind of goes up from there.
Yeah.
Whether you start dedicating yourself to, start being certified, taking the USGA rules exam to earn a certification. I think that's, part of it. And then once you have that, you start going on and officiating more things, whether it's, professional events or getting involved in USGA stuff.
Right.
Or higher level stuff in your state, whatever the case is. I think, once you get past that one rung on the ladder of wanting to be an official. It just, you can just keep making more steps.
Right. So why don't you talk about that process and what certified means, what our role is as a state association, what the USGA's role is. So for those that have not already turned the channel, so to speak, because they really are interested in becoming a rules official, how does that all work?
I think it starts at your local level. I think anyone who wants to be an official or wants to get into rules officiating, I think the best place to start is with your AGA. Here in Colorado, that would be us, the CGA. Or if you're listening from out of state, go on the USGA's website, and there's a whole list of where your AGA can be found, where regardless of whatever state you might be in. I think that's probably the best place to get started at the local level, because a lot of AGAs, just like us, they offer rules education, in whether it's their off season or during their season. We at the CGA, we do both virtual and in-person rules seminars. We try and cover a lot of material at each one. The idea would be that anyone who attends our rules seminars walks away from them taking a piece of information they didn't have before. Or if maybe they, like I said, maybe they're on that surface level interested in getting into officiating, maybe they can find out more information on how they can use that knowledge now to make that next step. So I think the best place really is at the local level. Once you're involved at the local level, it gets a lot easier to make those other steps, whether it's now going off to attending a USGA workshop or, you know, getting more involved in your local association's tournaments or championships. So I think once you're involved at that local level, the path can be a little bit easier to recognize.
So we have a number of rules seminars being offered right now on our website. I noticed virtual and in person. Is that right? So that would be kind of step one. So let's say step two, I've been there before. I've done that. Now I want to go to a USGA rules seminar. What is involved in that? What do those look like? And talk about this famous test that is a part of that workshop, as we call them, and how you've been preparing. So there's a lot there. So just start with what's involved in the USGA workshop and the test.
Well, the workshop, and let me be clear, there's a very difference between attending a seminar like we do and attending what we call a workshop. A lot of our seminars are, you know, a couple hours or, you know, maybe a half day, whatever the case might be. The USGA PGA workshop is a 3.5-4 day endeavor. It's really, if you're attending this, one, you're either really serious about getting involved in the rules and, you know, making that way to certification, or you've already gone through your local stuff. You've been there, done that. And maybe you just, I want a little bit more. I want more than just one day, half day, you know, a couple hours. I want the full experience. So they're offered all over the country, both virtual and in person. I myself prefer the in-person one vastly more than the virtual. The virtual rules school works for some people. The way they do virtual rules schools, it's over a 5-day period and it's 2 hours a day. And they try and cover the entire book in that period. For me, it doesn't work. I really like going somewhere, interacting with other people, listening to instructors in person, and going through the rule book 1 through 25. So the registration form opens usually every November, end of October, start of November. Registration opens up, sign up, you pay your workshop fee, it's $500. You have the option also to take the test along with that included in that fee. So if you would like to take the test as well, that it's included in that $500.
Are they still offering two tests, a kind of a light version?
They do.
Yeah.
There's two exams. There is an 80 question and a 100 question. The 100 question USGA exam is really the gold standard for rules knowledge. If you really want to see where your knowledge stacks up, the 100 question exam is the way to do it. There's nothing wrong with the 80 question exam. That you still have a possibility to attain what they call advanced certification. With the 80 question exam, you have to get 70 of 80 questions right. With the 100 question exam, there's two different certifications to earn: advanced certification or expert certification. And expert is really someone who has achieved expert certification. It's really the gold standard of rules knowledge in our world.
And to achieve that, you have to score 90 or higher, is that correct?
Expert is 90 or above. Okay. Advanced certification now, I believe, is 75 to 89.
Okay.
On the 100 question test.
Right.
So really, again, that expert certification that all of us aim to achieve for. And now the way they do it now is that with the cycles, right now we're in a rule cycle 2023 through 2027. 2027 being our next revision of the rules. That's one rule cycle there, 23 through 27. As long as you achieve that expert once in that cycle, you're good for the cycle. So last year was the first year of the cycle. I went off, I tested, got expert, so I am good for the entire cycle through 2027.
Right. So let's talk more about preparing for the workshop if you're really serious. This is very timely. This is what you've been focused on now that the tournament season, we're dormant at the moment. So what have you been doing to, because you taking that test is really a big part of your goal here. It's not just going and interacting and learning. That's part of it, but it's going to be quantified when you lights are on and the number two pencil comes out and you start grinding away.
Well, in my case, it's a mouse instead of a number two.
Oh, okay.
Since I opt to do my test online instead of
okay.
in person.
Okay. Yeah, maybe that would help me. I don't know. So how do you prepare for the test?
Well, one thing I always tell people who have never taken the test before, or it's their first time taking it, or whatever the case is there's no way to rely on your, you know, a lot of people say, oh, I've played golf for my whole life, or I've played golf for 25 years. I know the rules and I can do it. There's no way to rely on just your knowledge of playing golf to get through the exam. Honestly, it's a recipe for failure. It does take a lot of studying. It takes a lot of time commitment to put your nose in the book, take practice exams, do all those things to really get the score you want. If your goal is a 70 or a 75 on the exam, then, you know, do what you need to do. But for the people like me who aims for 99s, 100s, whatever, that's my ultimate goal. My high score on the exam is 95 to this point. So 100 is still out there. And my exam for me is 1 week from Wednesday. So the lights will come on January 31st this year. Even though, like I said, even though I've already tested expert in this cycle, mm-hmm. I still like to do it every year to keep fresh.
Yeah, like I said, I'm a rusty on this. I started taking the rules test in the late 80s, casually, kind of like you described, just kind of a drive-by. Mm-hmm. The osmosis, hope I've picked up enough just rubbing elbows, and then really asserted myself probably in the mid-90s when I really started to try and was able to crack into the 90s. You know, you're absolutely right. It's a commitment. You have to try. Particularly, some people are better test takers than others. And really, said more specifically, some people are better readers, comprehenders, and they're just more careful. Because the test is, if you're a sloppy reader, if you struggle, you know, it's a marathon. It's 3 hours, mm-hmm. Half the test. Is 50
four,
questions?
4 hours.
Is it 4 hours? Okay. 4 hours. Oh my gosh. I'd forgotten. It's been a while. But half the questions, the first 50, you are not allowed to use materials. So it's closed book. And the second half is open book. I always preferred the closed book because I just felt like, because the stress of, and I tried to manage my time accordingly, which was advice that a lot of experienced test takers would give. Manage your time, you know, maybe 2/3 of your time for the closed book, so you have time to, because theoretically you shouldn't miss any questions on the open book if you know how to use the materials properly. So that worked fairly well for me. Another piece of advice was answer both parts without any materials and then go back.
Yeah, that's what I do. Yeah. I treat both parts as a closed book exam.
Yeah.
If I can try and get through the question without going to my reference materials, then I only do it if I need to.
Yeah.
Because if you go through the open book exam and you're a page flipper on every question, you're either one, going to run out of time, or you're just going to start finding useless stuff.
Right.
You're not going to get to the heart of the problem.
Right.
So.
Yeah. And if you find yourself, that really resonates with me because I would, you know, and I got better at this over the years in just recognizing I'm chasing my tail here. Let's just skip this one and come back. Because if you don't manage it, that's like 101. Manage your time. Yeah. Make sure you don't get stuck there. Because many times you'll see a question like, all of the following are true except. So first of all, I don't think they do that anymore. That's just kind of almost sneaky, because if you don't read it, all the following are true, and you see the word true, which is usually in all caps, so that's just sort of gamesmanship almost. They're trying to trap you. My point about that particular style of question, you may have to look up five things to get, you know, usually you can eliminate one or two right away, but you're going to have two or three, I'm dating myself, decisions to look up or to locate interpretations, because they're usually not really just straight away, mm-hmm. you know.
So we kind of glossed over that with the format of the test. It's a 100-question test, and all the questions are multiple choice.
Right.
Four answer multiple choice.
Yeah.
On both versions, 80 or 100. They're all four answer multiple choice. And really, if you can go into the question and eliminate two of the answers right away, you give yourself a pretty good chance. Mm-hmm. One of the best pieces of advice someone gave me, and this was like two or three attempts into taking this exam, was read the last sentence of the question first. And the reason why they say that is because usually the last sentence of the question is asking is what you're trying to find. Is asking what you're trying to find.
Yeah.
A lot of times it's, you know, how many penalty strokes does this player get, or what is the score for the hole?
Right.
Or what is, you know, true, or what is the ruling? So if you know what they're asking you to find, that kind of helps you read the question a little more selectively.
Right. No, that's good advice. It's kind of like all the questions I ask are like 20 sentences led up to maybe, you know, the final sentence, which is actually the question.
I kind of didn't really answer any questions. Back to how I study for the exam.
Yeah.
So our tournament season usually ends first weekend of October. And like I mentioned before, the workshop usually opens up around the 1st of November. So between our tournament season ending in October and workshops starting to open, I usually take that roughly 1 month time frame and read one rule a day. There's 25 rules in the book as of 2023. So somewhere in that 20, you know, that 1 month time frame, I can get 25 days and I'll read 1 through 25, one a day.
So you're done with that? You did that already or not?
Checked off the list a long time ago.
Oh, okay.
So before workshop registration even opens, I've usually read 1 through 25.
Okay. Now let me ask a question. When you say read, you literally are just reading it.
Just reading it like a book.
Okay.
I am trying to learn stuff and I'm trying to retain information, but I'm just reading it.
Yeah.
So what I do is I read it out loud to myself.
Yeah. Okay.
Like I'm almost trying to teach myself,
right,
what I'm reading. So I usually try and read it once all the way through 1 through 25. After that, I'll read the definitions. I'll take a week and read the definitions just over and over again. And then leading up to Thanksgiving, I'll do the same thing. I'll read 1 through 25 again. So usually before December 1, I'll have gone through the book twice. Gone through 1 through 25, definitions 1 through 25. And then in December is when I usually start taking practice exams. I usually try to do 20 questions a day, 20, 25 questions a day, just boom, 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 boom. Just do them in the morning, one sitting, just do them. Mm-hmm. And I'll alternate topics. What I usually like to do, especially as I get closer to the exam, I'll go back on my old exams and see what topics I didn't score as well on. And I'll focus my questions on those specific topics. So if I didn't exactly, let's just say I didn't do well on dropping as a topic, I'll do 20 questions solely just on dropping the ball.
And the practice tests allow you to do that, where you can be that. Mm-hmm. You can kind of choose an area to test me on the following.
Yep.
See, this is all new to me. These tools are helpful.
So then usually, so like I mentioned, I'm taking my exam on the 31st of this month. As of when the calendar flipped over as of January 1, that's when I started upping my question count each day. Instead of doing 20 or 25, maybe
it's like training for a marathon.
I do 35 or 40 questions. And usually when I get to about 2.5 weeks out from the test date, I'll do 50 a day, because it kind of simulates half of, you know, one half of the exam being 50 questions.
Right.
So I'll usually do 50 a day.
Well, and there's no doubt, and people say, what's the best way to study for the exam or to score well on the exam? It's to practice. It's like anything else. It's just like golf. You got to go practice, and there's only one way to do it, and that's to read questions. You can put your nose in the book and, you know, try to, you know, run around, read the entire, what do we call it now? It's interpretations. What do we call that book? The guidebook? What do we?
It used to be the decisions book is the official guide.
And the official guide?
Instead of decisions. Well, it went from decisions prior to 19 to interpretations from 19 to 22. And now as of 2023, they're called clarifications.
Clarifications. Okay. Again, my terminology is out of date.
Once we get to a month out on the test, it doesn't really benefit me to put my nose in the book again.
Right.
Because at this point, I should.
You've done all that work. Now you go to the workshop, and you're going to two workshops, because you can touch on that, because they also have specialized workshops for referees, for on course, I assume. Mm-hmm. So I'd like you to talk about that. But this first one you're going to is a traditional workshop, is that correct?
So it's just a regular, the same, you know, they still go through the book 1 through 25, the definitions. The only thing, this one in particular is the expert workshop. So to be able to sign up for this workshop, you would have had to score 90 or above.
So everybody sitting in that workshop has
tested.
So theoretically, you're not going to get any stupid questions.
Theoretically.
We know that's not true.
and from what I've heard, starting this year, they're adding some stuff to this specific workshop that they don't do with the other ones.
Okay.
They're adding a section on TIOs. They're adding a section on model local rules. So they're adding some other stuff.
Right. It was always fascinating to me to go to these workshops, and everybody's studied, right, so to varying degrees. Some have really studied like you have, or some have maybe used the week to do their studying. But to look around the room and see how people are processing the information that's being delivered. Mm-hmm. And some are actually got a book out and they're highlighting as things go along. Some have their guidebook open and they're tagging it and dog-earing pages. Others are just sitting back listening, fully attentive. Some people are checking their email and everything. Anything in between?
A couple observations, and the one I'm going to this weekend. This will be my eighth workshop I've attended.
Mm-hmm.
Just observations I've had over the years of going to the workshops, and I don't know if maybe there is, maybe it's just in my head. I do think there's a correspondence between how far forward you sit in the class and how well your test score is.
No doubt.
There's got to be some correlation in those
things. And then you have people who say they have a bad back, so they have to get up and stretch and walk around. And there's probably a few outliers, but you're right. The people who are serious are going to sit. And I always sat up front because I knew I would be kind of hold myself accountable. Mm-hmm. If I'm in the back, there's no doubt. It's like being in the splash zone when you go to SeaWorld. You're not going to get wet in the back.
Yes, same here. I always try and sit within the first two rows.
Yeah.
I'm there for a reason.
Yeah, that and actually.
One, I'm there for a reason. And two, it's important to me.
Yeah. That actually came back to bite me one year. I was at a workshop, Ken Lindsay, Kendra Graham. This was in the early 90s. And Ken Lindsay, who was the PGA instructor, and we didn't mention that. There's always one USGA representative there, almost always, usually a staff member.
Either a staff member or someone on the committee.
Right. Nine times out of 10, probably a staff member on the PGA side. It's rarely a staff member. It's almost always somebody on their committee. But really good, different styles. Anyway, I was in the front row and Ken Lindsay posed a question about distance measuring devices. This is way before they were made legal. And I was sitting in the front row and he said, how many people here by show of hands would legalize distance measuring devices? And I raised my hand and I didn't really have any I didn't realize no other hand went up. And I felt at the time, why not? Again, it just shows that I was ahead of my time. And then I proceeded to be a little embarrassed because I looked around. I was the only hand. So that's one of the downsides of sitting in the front row. So that's the test. Talk about this other workshop you're going to. This is a what's it called and what's the content going to be?
Yeah, so the, like you mentioned, going to two. Traditionally, you're only allowed to take the test once a year. Mm-hmm. So, but you can attend as many workshops as you so desire, as long as you, you know the USJ will take your $500. I don't care.
And that's the cost,
$500.
Okay.
So, the in certain years, and they're getting really good about offering it every year now. They used to only offer it once every couple of years, but now this is the second year in a row, or maybe third year in a row, they've offered it. But this is the USGA refereeing workshop. I think formerly it used to be known as the tournament administration workshop.
Mm-hmm.
So, I believe now they're calling it the refereeing workshop, and this is solely focused. Not so much on the rules like they do in the regular workshop. It's solely focused on on-course refereeing, how to walk into a situation, how to deal with a player, how to recognize different elements of a ruling, how to process that information, you know, how to do those things when you're on course in a refereeing capacity. A bit different. They don't necessarily have a PGA instructor, a USGA instructor. They bring in a lot of tour staff from all the tours that come in and help teach some of that material. A lot of the USJ rules department's there and in that capacity as well. So it's structured a bit different than the regular workshop. What I'm looking forward to about this one is they do it at TPC Sawgrass, and they do it about six and a half weeks out from the Players' Championship. So a lot of build out is going on at TPC. We get the opportunity to go on course, walk through how to, markings, course setup, doing the rulings, stuff like that. So it's just structured a bit different than sitting in a hotel ballroom looking at a PowerPoint for 4 days.
Right. And have you been to this one before?
I have not. This will be my first one.
No, that's great. Well, and we talk about this all the time, what it takes to be a good rules official. The test is really kind of like passing, sitting for the bar. But just because you pass the bar doesn't mean you're a good lawyer. And all the other bedside manner and people skills come into play. And some of that stuff you can learn and some you can't. There's a certain amount of common sense and personality that's sort of part of that equation. And frankly, it's harder to find those qualities. That's sort of a natural gift almost than it is. I mean, I wouldn't say anybody. And if you can score 100 on the rules test, that's amazing. I've never scored 100. That's incredible to me. And you know the rules. And there's no doubt people who say, well, I know the rules just as well, I just don't take tests as well. I would push back on that. If you got 100, you know the rules better than somebody who scored 95. And it's not just because you're a better test taker. The better you know the rules, the better you score. And now some people, again, are going to – but at any rate, I would rather have somebody that said who scored 95 and has a personality than somebody who scored 100.
Well, I always likened it to there's, speaking of my PGA background here, there's probably a lot of people out there who are phenomenal teachers of the golf swing,
mm-hmm.
but they can't play worth a lick. So they'll never be a PGA member, a PGA professional, and pursue teaching golf that route.
Right.
But they might be phenomenal teachers of the golf swing, and they might have that knowledge, but maybe they just can't get past that one part of it. Same thing. There might be some people who have phenomenal bedside manner and interact with players super well, but maybe they just keep scoring 87, 88, 89, 88 mm-hmm. over and over and over again. They just can't get to that
right.
expert level certification on the exam.
Yeah. Also, another analogy I think of is golf course designer Seth Rayner. I just found this out recently. Never played golf.
I did know that.
That's unbelievable. And here's a guy who worked with C.B. McDonald, one of the greatest designers ever. He never played golf, and he kind of kept it that way on purpose. He thought it would taint and give him an agenda that there was a certain objectivity that came from not being distracted by the chasing a white ball.
I can't wait to meet the referee that doesn't play golf.
Yeah.
That would be something else.
Well, there's definitely referees who play very little golf, either because they've aged out of the game or they just, and the other problem is if you're serious about it, it takes most of your time. It's such an amazing commitment of time if you really, and I'm just in awe of these people who do it as volunteers, particularly on USGA committees, and travel the country at their own expense and work from sunup to sundown. It really is a special type of person that is attracted to this. All I can say is I'm blown away at how hard you've worked to get ready. And if you don't score 100 on the test, it won't be for lack of trying. That's for sure. effort.
Yeah,
for sure.
The nice thing is that, you know, since I already have an expert certification for this cycle, since I scored expert last year, in a way, some pressure is off.
Yeah, that's true.
I can go in there and I can just take the test freely and, you know, see what happens.
Well, and the other thing, when you take it every year, you stay sharp. And if you let time pass, just like a language, it really, that is a very, very much an analogy. If you don't use a foreign language, you will lose it. Mm-hmm. Same is very much true with the rules and taking that test. I noticed that I was very proud of the fact that for the first maybe 10 times I took the test, my score went up. And then it finally, my ceiling was 98. And then it fell back. And it happened to fall back at a time where I took 2 or 3 years off. And boy, I think I dropped down to the low 90s. And then I've even dropped back into the 80s. That was really my last test. I did score in the 92 or higher, but I am not certified. I have not scored. I did have a score in the previous cycle, but I'll see if I'm serious enough to try to take it in the next 3 or 4 years.
Well, the other thing I've noticed, especially since in the last couple times I've taken the test, since I've gotten more into teaching the rules and doing our CGA seminars, in the time that I've gotten more into that, my test score has continued to go up.
Yeah.
I think that plays a little bit of a part into it too.
No, and every teacher out there will smile at that comment. And my dad was a high school history teacher. My mom was a teacher. My brother's a college professor, and I have a soft spot for teachers. And there's no doubt, if you want to learn a subject of any kind, teach it. Yeah. You mentioned teaching the golf swing. The best teachers of the golf swing are those who can describe the same thing 10 different ways for the different learning styles. To this day, the thing I enjoy more than any other thing when it comes to the rules is participating in workshops and teaching, mm-hmm. Because it's just so rewarding. I know David Stabler talked about this, who was the director of rules education for many years for the USGA, just recently retired. But when you get a student who gets something and you explained it in a way, or even better, when they say something to you and you're like, man, I never thought of that way. One of my favorite exchanges was at a rules seminar that Trey Holland was conducting it was in New Mexico. I don't know if it was in Las Cruces. I think it was in Albuquerque. Mm. And this woman asked the question, and I said woman for a reason, and it was more of a statement than a question. And it was basically, it went something along these lines. If your ball comes to rest in a sandy area through the green, using the dated terminology, isn't it just as much of a penalty to ground your club in that situation? She was basically going right out of Principles of the Rules of Golf from Richard Tufts and just clarifying this, as it is to ground your club in a bunker. And Trey Holland, rather than answering the question, said, are you married? And the room just cracked up because it was such a perfect answer, because it really spoke to just how much this student appreciated the spirit of the game. The name of our podcast. So it's delightful to get just these, you know, what ifs, and it's really colored my appreciation for the rules and my knowledge of the rules just by getting really good questions.
So, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, anything else to add as we sign off for this month?
No.
Okay.
As of when you're hearing this podcast, I will have already taken my rules exam.
So. All right. So we'll have to remember that when we come back on March 1st, we're going to announce. You're going to be okay to disclose your score? Are you going to?
As long as the USGA turns my results around. they're usually, ever since they started doing the online proctoring,
yeah,
they've usually been pretty good about getting the scores back sooner.
Do you find that the online clicking a mouse is actually, is there something about that specifically? Because I know, in all seriousness, I joked about the number 2 pencil, but I more than once missed a question because I misbubbled.
I think, well, for me, I think it works better because it mirrors my preparation.
Yeah.
I take my practice exams.
That's true.
Sitting there on my laptop, clicking the mouse and reading the question across my screen.
Yeah.
So it just mirrors my preparation.
Yeah. Something we didn't talk about is I used to write all over that booklet. Mm-hmm. I'd circle words. I'd do the old T-square where you show strokes and penalty strokes. So when you have a question that requires you to answer how many strokes were taken. And that was really important to me. I'm a kind of analog thinker. So I don't know. Do you still do that? Because trying to...
I keep some scrap paper on my desk.
Yeah.
Because I do the same thing. I make the T-chart when I'm counting out strokes.
Yeah, yeah.
So like you used to do it in your test booklet. I just keep a scrap piece of paper.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll say a prayer for you on January 31st or put out some good vibes into the golfing gods universe. But I like your chances. What's the saying? Proper preparation prevents poor performance. Well, you've done all the P's and crossed all the I's and T's.
Yeah, no, it's like I said, I think having that benchmark already set, that the certification has already been earned, I think that helps going forward. And like I said, every year, as I've been doing more teaching of seminars and refining my preparation, my score just continues to go up. So,
well, if you're lucky enough to attend one of Lewis's rule seminars between now and the start of the season, you will benefit from it. I've worked with a lot of really good rules people. And one thing I know about your style is you are almost always accurate in what you say. What I mean by that is you don't misspeak. It's easy to, you just take them, and that ability serves you well, and it's really great to go to your seminars, because it's very frustrating when you go to a seminar and the instructor has misspoken, and it's an important point they're making, and I look around the room, I'm like, I hope people didn't take that comment too seriously. So it's not easy to teach, and even harder to teach accurately. So
good.
All right, that's it for this month.
Until next time.